Chapter 7. What are the political effects of bullshit jobs? And is there anything that can be done about this situation? I believe that this instinct to perpetuate useless work is, at bottom, simply fear of the mob. The mob, the thought runs, are such low animals that they would be dangerous if they had leisure. It is safer to keep them too busy to think. George Orwell, Down and Out in Paris and London. If someone had designed a work regime perfectly suited to maintaining the power of finance capital, it's hard to see how they could have done a better job. Real, productive workers are relentlessly squeezed and exploited. The remainder are divided between a terrorized stratum of the universally reviled unemployed and a larger stratum who are basically paid to do nothing in positions designed to make them identify with the perspectives and sensibilities of the ruling class, managers, administrators, etc., and particularly its financial avatars, but at the same time foster a simmering resentment against anyone whose work has clear and undeniable social value. From On the Phenomenon of Bullshit Jobs. I would like to end this book with a few thoughts about the political implications of the current work situation, and one suggestion about a possible way out. What I have described over the last two chapters are the economic forces driving the proliferation of bullshit jobs, what I've called managerial feudalism, and the cosmology, the overall way of imagining the place of human beings in the universe, that allows us to put up with this arrangement. The more the economy becomes a matter of the mere distribution of loot, the more inefficiency and unnecessary chains of command actually make sense, since these are the forms of organization best suited to soaking up as much of that loot as possible. The less the value of work is seen to lie either in what it produces or the benefits it provides to others, the more work comes to be seen as valuable primarily as a form of self-sacrifice, which means that anything that makes that work less onerous or more enjoyable, even the gratification of knowing that one's work benefits others, is actually seen to lower its value, and, as a result, to justify lower levels of pay. All this is genuinely perverse. In a sense, those critics who claim we are not working a 15-hour week because we have chosen consumerism over leisure are not entirely off the mark. They just got the mechanisms wrong. We're not working harder because we're spending all our time manufacturing PlayStations and serving one another sushi. Industry is being increasingly robotized, and the real service sector remains flat at roughly 20% of overall employment. Instead, it is because we have invented a bizarre sadomasochistic dialectic whereby we feel that pain in the workplace is the only possible justification for our furtive consumer pleasures, and, at the same time, the fact that our jobs thus come to eat up more and more of our waking existence means that we do not have the luxury of, as Kathy Weeks has so concisely put it, a life, and that, in turn, means that furtive consumer pleasures are the only ones we have time to afford. Sitting around in cafes all day arguing about politics or gossiping about our friends' complex polyamorous love affairs takes time, all day in fact. In contrast, pumping iron or attending a yoga class at the local gym, ordering out for Deliveroo, watching an episode of Game of Thrones, or shopping for hand creams or consumer electronics can all be placed in the kind of self-contained, predictable time slots one is likely to have left over between spates of work, or else while recovering from it. All these are examples of what I like to call compensatory consumerism. They are the sorts of things you can do to make up for the fact that you don't have a life, or not very much of one. On how the political culture under managerial feudalism comes to be maintained by a balance of resentments. Now, at the time of which I was speaking, as the voters were inscribing their ostraca to determine which politician would be expelled from the city, it is said that an unlettered and utterly boorish fellow handed his ostrakon to Aristides, whom he took to be one of the ordinary crowd, and asked him to write Aristides on it. He, astonished, asked the man what possible wrong Aristides had done him. None whatever, was the answer. I don't even know the fellow, but I am tired of hearing him everywhere called the Just. On hearing this, Aristides made no answer, but wrote his name on the ostracon and handed it back. Plutarch, Life of Aristides the Just. No doubt I am overstating my case. People in consumer societies, even those in bullshit jobs, do eke out some kind of life. Though one might ask how viable such forms of life really are in the long term, considering that the stratum of the population most likely to be trapped in pointless employment would also appear to be the most likely to have lives marked by episodes of clinical depression or other forms of mental illness, not to mention to fail to reproduce. At least I suspect that this is the case. Such suspicions could only be affirmed by empirical research. Even if none of this turned out to be the case, though, one thing is inescapable. Such work arrangements foster a political landscape rife with hatred and resentment. Those struggling and without work resent the employed. The employed are encouraged to resent the poor and unemployed, who they are constantly told are scroungers and freeloaders. Those trapped in bullshit jobs resent workers who get to do real productive or beneficial labor. And those who do real productive or beneficial labor, underpaid, degraded, and unappreciated, increasingly resent those who they see as monopolizing those few jobs where one can live well while doing something useful, high-minded, or glamorous, who they refer to as the liberal elite. All are united in their loathing for the political class, who they see, correctly, as corrupt, but the political class, in turn, finds these other forms of vacuous hatred extremely convenient, since they distract attention from themselves. Some of these forms of resentment are familiar enough, and will be instantly recognizable by the listener. Others are less discussed, and might seem at first puzzling. It's easy to imagine how someone working in a French tea factory might resent the flock of useless new middle managers imposed on them, even before those middle managers decided to fire them all. It's not nearly so clear why those middle managers should resent the factory workers. But often middle managers, and even more those managers' administrative assistants, clearly do resent factory workers, for the simple reason that the latter have legitimate reason to take pride in their work. A key part of the justification of underpaying such workers is simple envy. Moral envy is an under-theorized phenomenon. I'm not sure that anyone has ever written a book about it. Still, it's clearly an important factor in human affairs. By moral envy, I am referring here to feelings of envy and resentment directed at another person, not because that person is wealthy or gifted or lucky, but because his or her behavior is seen as upholding a higher moral standard than the envier's own. The basic sentiment seems to be, how dare that person claim to be better than me, by acting in a way that I do indeed acknowledge is better than me. I remember first encountering this attitude in college when a lefty friend once told me that he no longer had any respect for a certain famous activist, since he had learned the activist in question kept an expensive apartment in New York for his ex-wife and child. "What a hypocrite," he exclaimed. "He could have given that money to the poor." When I pointed out the activist in question gave almost all his money to the poor, he was unmoved. When I pointed out the critic, while not exactly poor himself, appeared to give nothing to charity, he was offended. In fact, I'm not sure he ever spoke to me again. I've run into this attitude repeatedly ever since. Within a community of do-gooders, anyone who exemplifies shared values in too exemplary a way is seen as a threat. Ostentatiously good behavior, virtue signaling is the new catchword, is often perceived as a moral challenge. It doesn't matter if the person in question is entirely humble and unassuming. In fact, that can make it even worse, since humility can be seen as itself a moral challenge to those who secretly feel they aren't humble enough. Moral envy of this sort is rife in activist or religious communities. What I would like to suggest here is that it is also more subtly present in the politics surrounding work. Just as anger at immigrants often involves the simultaneous accusation that newcomers work both too much and too little, so does resentment against the poor focus simultaneously on those who don't work, since they are imagined to be lazy, and those who do work, since, unless they've been dragooned into some kind of workfare, at least they don't have bullshit jobs. Why, for instance, have conservatives in the United States been so successful at whipping up popular resentment against unionized hospital or auto workers? During the 2008 bailout of the financial industry, while there was a public outcry against bankers' million-dollar bonuses, no actual sanctions followed. However, the consequent bailout of the auto industry did involve sanctions on assembly line workers. They were widely denounced as coddled for having union contracts that allowed them generous health and pension plans, vacations, and $28 per hour wages, and forced into massive givebacks. Those working in the financial offices of the same companies who, insofar as they were not just sitting around doing nothing at all, were the ones who had actually caused the problems and were not expected to make similar sacrifices. As a local paper recalled, the bank bailout would be followed in February by a bailout of auto companies. Here, it was assumed that thousands of jobs must be shed for those companies to regain profitability. There had long been envy of auto workers' job protection and health benefits. Now, they became a scapegoat. As once proud Michigan manufacturing cities all but shut down, right-wing radio commentators asserted that workers, instrumental historically through their labor struggles in obtaining 7-day work weeks and 40-hour days for everyone, were getting their just desserts. Matthew Kopka in Bailing Out Wall Street While the Ship of State is Sinking. At the same time, one frequently circulated claim was that auto workers were making as much as $75 an hour, but this was based on an industry PR statement that took the total costs of all wages, benefits, and pensions for all workers and divided them by the total number of hours worked. Obviously, if one calculated by these means, almost any worker in any industry could be represented as getting 2 or 3 times his or her actual hourly wage. One reason American auto workers had such relatively generous plans, compared with other blue-collar workers, was first and foremost because they played such an essential role in creating something their fellow citizens actually needed, and what's more, something recognized as culturally important, indeed central to their sense of themselves as Americans. The second reason was that as factory workers, they were all concentrated in the same place, which made it easy to organize together. This meant that they could threaten strikes that would have a serious effect on the economy. It's hard to escape the impression that this was precisely what others resented about them. They get to make cars. Shouldn't that be enough for them? I have to sit around filling out stupid forms all day, and these bastards want to rub it in by threatening to go on strike to demand a dental plan or 2 weeks off to take their kids to see the Grand Canyon or the Coliseum on top of that? It's quite the same with the otherwise inexplicable drumbeat of animosity directed, in the United States, against primary and secondary school teachers. School teachers, of course, are the very definition of those who chose a socially important and high-minded vocation in the full knowledge that it would involve low pay and stressful conditions. One becomes a teacher because one wants to have a positive impact on others' lives. As a New York subway recruiting ad used to say, no one ever called someone up 20 years later to thank them for being such an inspiring insurance claims adjuster. Yet again, this seems to be what makes them fair game in the eyes of all those who denounce them as spoiled, entitled, overpaid spouters of secular humanist anti-Americanism. Granted, one can understand why Republican activists target teachers' unions. Teachers' unions are one of the mainstays of support for the Democratic Party. But teachers' unions include both teachers and school administrators, the latter being those actually responsible for most of the policies most Republican activists object to. So why not focus on them? It would have been much easier for them to make a case that the school administrators are overpaid parasites than that teachers are coddled and spoiled. As Eli Horowitz noted, "What's remarkable about this is that Republicans and other conservatives actually did complain about school administrators, but then they stopped. For whatever reason, those voices, which were few and quiet to begin with, dwindled to non-existence almost as soon as the conversation began. In the end, the teachers themselves turned out to be the more valid political targets, even though they do the more valuable work." Again, I think this can be put down to moral envy. Teachers are seen as people who have ostentatiously put themselves forward as self-sacrificing and public-spirited, as wanting to be the sort of person who gets a call 20 years later saying, thank you for all you did for me. For people like that to form unions, threaten strikes, and demand better working conditions is considered almost hypocritical. There is one major exception to the rule that anyone pursuing a useful or high-minded line of work, but who also expects comfortable levels of pay and benefits, is a legitimate target of resentment. The rule does not apply to soldiers or anyone else who works directly for the military. To the contrary, soldiers must never be resented. They are above critique. I've written about this curious exception before, but it might be helpful to recall the argument very briefly because I think it's impossible to really understand right-wing populism without it. What follows is drawn largely from an essay that appeared in long format as Introduction: The Political Metaphysics of Stupidity in The Commoner, spring 2005, and shorter format in Harper's as Army of Altruists on the Alienated Right to Do Good. Let me again take the case of America, because it's the one I'm most familiar with, though I'm assured the argument, in its broad outlines, does apply anywhere from Brazil to Japan. For right-wing populists in particular, military personnel are the ultimate good guys. One must support the troops. This is an absolute injunction. Anyone who would compromise on it in any way is a traitor, pure and simple. The ultimate bad guys, in contrast, are the intelligentsia. Most working-class conservatives, for instance, don't have much use for corporate executives, but they usually don't feel especially passionate about their dislike for them. Their true hatred is directed at the liberal elite. This divides into various branches: the Hollywood elite, the journalistic elite, university elite, fancy lawyers, or the medical establishment. That is, the sort of people who live in big coastal cities, watch public television or public radio, or even more, who might be involved in producing or appearing in same. It seems to me there are two perceptions that lie behind this resentment. One, the perception that members of this elite see ordinary working people as a bunch of knuckle-dragging cavemen, and two, the perception that these elites constitute an increasingly closed caste, one which the children of the working class would actually have far more difficulty breaking into than the class of actual capitalists. It also seems to me that both these perceptions are largely accurate. The first is pretty much self-evidently true if reactions to the 2016 election of Donald Trump are anything to go by. The white working class in particular is the one identity group in America toward which statements that might otherwise be immediately denounced as bigoted, for instance, that a certain class of people are ugly, violent, or stupid, are accepted without remark in polite society. The second is also true if you really think about it. We might again look to Hollywood for an illustration. Back in the 30s and 40s, even the name Hollywood would tend to evoke images of magical social advance. Hollywood was a place where a simple farm girl could go to the big city, be discovered, find herself a star. For present purposes, it doesn't really matter how often this actually happened. It clearly did now and then. The point is, at the time, Americans did not see the fable as inherently implausible. Look at a list of the lead actors of a major motion picture nowadays, and you are likely to find barely a single one that can't boast at least two generations of Hollywood actors, writers, producers, and directors in their family tree. The film industry has come to be dominated by an in-marrying caste. Is it surprising, then, that Hollywood celebrities' pretensions to egalitarian politics tend to ring a bit hollow in the ears of most working-class Americans. Neither is Hollywood in any way an exception in this regard. If anything, it's emblematic of what has happened to all the liberal professions, if perhaps a trifle more advanced. Conservative voters, I would suggest, tend to resent intellectuals more than they resent rich people, because they can imagine a scenario in which they or their children might become rich, but cannot possibly imagine one in which they could ever become a member of the cultural elite. If you think about it, that's not an unreasonable assessment. A truck driver's daughter from Nebraska might not have very much chance of becoming a millionaire. America now has the lowest social mobility in the developed world, but it could happen. There's virtually no way that same daughter will ever become an international human rights lawyer or drama critic for the New York Times. Even if she could get into the right schools, there would certainly be no possible way for her to then go on to live in New York or San Francisco for the requisite years of unpaid internships. Insofar as there are not quite enough children of privilege to go around, since elites almost never give birth to enough offspring to reproduce themselves demographically, the jobs are likely to go to the most remarkable children of immigrants. Executives with Bank of America or Enron, when facing a similar demographic problem, are much more likely to recruit from poorer white folk like themselves. This is partly because of racism, partly too because corporations tend to encourage a broadly anti-intellectual climate themselves. It is well known at Yale, where I once worked, that executive recruiters tend to prefer to hire Yale's B students, since they are more likely to be people they'll feel comfortable with. Even if the son of a glazier got a toehold in a well-positioned bullshit job, he would likely, like Eric, be unable or unwilling to transform it into a platform for the obligatory networking. There are 1,000 invisible barriers. If we return to the opposition of value versus values laid out in the last chapter, we might put it this way. If you just want to make a lot of money, there might be a way to do it. On the other hand, if your aim is to pursue any other sort of value, whether that be truth, journalism, academia, beauty, the art world, publishing, justice, activism, human rights, charity, and so forth, and you actually want to be paid a living wage for it, then if you do not possess a certain degree of family wealth, social networks, and cultural capital, there's simply no way in. The liberal elite, then, are those who have placed an effective lock on any position where it's possible to get paid to do anything that one might do for any reason other than the money. They are seen as trying, and largely succeeding, in constituting themselves as a new American nobility, in the same sense as the Hollywood aristocracy, monopolizing the hereditary right to all those jobs where one can live well and still feel one is serving some higher purpose, which is to say, feel noble. In the United States, of course, all this is very much complicated by the country's legacy of slavery and inveterate racism. It's largely the white working class that expresses class resentment by focusing on intellectuals. African Americans, migrants, and the children of migrants tend to reject anti-intellectual politics and still see the educational system as the most likely means of social advancement for their children. This makes it easier for poor whites to see them as unfairly in alliance with rich white liberals. But what does all this have to do with supporting the troops? Well, if that truck driver's daughter was absolutely determined to find a job that would allow her to pursue something unselfish and high-minded, but still paid the rent and guaranteed access to adequate dental care, what options does she really have? If she's of a religious temperament, there might be some possibility in her local church. But such jobs are hard to come by. Mainly, she can join the army. The reality of the situation first came home to me over a decade ago when attending a lecture by Catherine Lutz, an anthropologist who has been carrying out a project studying the archipelago of U.S. overseas military bases. She made the fascinating observation that almost all of these bases organize outreach programs in which soldiers venture out to repair schoolrooms or to perform free dental checkups in nearby towns and villages. The ostensible reason for the programs was to improve relations with local communities, but they rarely have much impact in that regard. Still, even after the military discovered this, they kept the programs up because they had such an enormous psychological impact on the soldiers, many of whom would wax euphoric when describing them. For example, "This is why I joined the army. This is what military service is really all about. Not just defending your country, it's about helping people." Soldiers allowed to perform public service duties, they found, were 2 or 3 times more likely to re-enlist. I remember thinking, wait, so most of these people really want to be in the Peace Corps? And I duly looked it up and discovered, sure enough, to be accepted into the Peace Corps, you need to already have a college degree. The U.S. military is a haven for frustrated altruists. A case could be made that the great historical difference between what we call the left and the right largely turns on the relation between value and values. The left has always been about trying to collapse the gulf between the domain dominated by pure self-interest and the domain traditionally dominated by high-minded principles. The right has always been about prizing them even farther apart and then claiming ownership of both. They stand for both greed and charity. Hence the otherwise inexplicable alliance in the Republican Party between the free market libertarians and the values voters of the Christian right. What this comes down to in practice has usually been the political equivalent of a strategy of good cop, bad cop. First, unleash the chaos of the market to destabilize lives and all existing verities alike. Then, offer yourself up as the last bastion of the authority of church and fatherhood against the barbarians they have themselves unleashed. By juxtaposing the call to support the troops with condemnations of the liberal elite, the right is effectively calling out the left as hypocrites. They're saying, 60s campus radicals claimed they were trying to create a new society in which everyone could be happy idealists living in material prosperity, where under communism, the distinction between value and values would be annihilated, and all would work for the common good. But all they really ended up doing was to guarantee any jobs which allow one to feel like one is doing that are set aside exclusively for their own spoiled children. This has some very important implications for the nature of the societies we live in. One thing it suggests about capitalism more generally is that societies based on greed, even that say that human beings are inherently selfish and greedy, and then attempt to valorize this sort of behavior, don't really believe it, and secretly dangle out the right to behave altruistically as a reward for playing along. Only those who can prove their mettle at selfishness are to be afforded the right to be selfless. Or that's how the game is supposed to work. If you suffer and scheme, and by doing so manage to accumulate enough economic value, then you are allowed to cash in and turn your millions into something unique, higher, intangible, or beautiful. That is, turn value into values. You assemble a collection of Rembrandts or classic racing cars, or you set up a foundation and devote the rest of your life to charity. To skip straight to the end is obviously cheating. We are back to Abraham Lincoln's version of medieval life cycle service, with the proviso that now, the overwhelming majority of us can only expect to experience anything like full adulthood on retirement, if at all. Soldiers are the one legitimate exception because they serve their country. And, I suspect, because usually they don't get much out of it in the long run. This would explain why right-wing populace, so unconditional in their support for the troops during their term of service, seems so strangely indifferent to the fact that a large percentage of them end up spending the rest of their lives homeless, jobless, impoverished, addicted, or begging with no legs. A poor kid might tell himself he's joining the Marines for the educational and career opportunities, but everyone knows that's at best a crapshoot. Such is the nature of his sacrifice, hence of his true nobility. All the other objects of resentment I've mentioned so far can be seen as ostentatious violations of the principle of inverse relation of compensation and social benefit. Unionized auto workers and teachers perform a vitally necessary function, yet have the temerity to demand middle-class lifestyles. They are objects of a special ire, I suspect, by those trapped in soul-destroying, low- and middle-level bullshit jobs. Members of the liberal elite, of the Bill Maher or Angelina Jolie variety, are seen as having skipped to the front of every line they've ever been asked to stand on, so as to be able to monopolize the few jobs that do exist that are simultaneously fun, well-paid, and make a difference in the world, while at the same time presuming to represent themselves as the voice of social justice. They are the particular objects of resentment of the working class, whose painful, difficult, body-destroying, but equally socially useful labor never seems to strike such paragons of liberalism as of much interest or importance. At the same time, that indifference would seem to overlap with the outright envious hostility of those members of the liberal classes trapped in higher-order bullshit jobs toward those same working classes for their ability to make an honest living. How the current crisis over robotization relates to the larger problem of bullshit jobs. Puritanism. The haunting fear that someone, somewhere, may be happy. H.L. Mencken. A crisscrossing of resentments increasingly defines the politics of wealthy countries. This is a disastrous state of affairs. It seems to me all this makes the old leftist question: every day we wake up and collectively make a world together. But which one of us, left to our own devices, would ever decide they wanted to make a world like this one? More relevant than ever. In many respects, the science fiction fantasies of the early 20th century have become possible. We can't teleport or place colonies on Mars, it's true, but we could easily rearrange matters in such a way that pretty much everyone on Earth lived lives of relative ease and comfort. In material terms, this would not be very difficult. While the pace at which scientific revolutions and technological breakthroughs occur has slowed considerably since the heady pace the world came to be familiar with from roughly 1750 to 1950, improvements in robotics continue, largely because they are a matter of improved application of existing technological knowledge. Combined with advances in materials science, they are ushering in an age where a very large proportion of the most dreary and tiresome mechanical tasks can indeed be eliminated. What this means is that work, as we know it, will less and less resemble what we think of as productive labor, and more resemble caring labor. Since, after all, caring consists mainly of the sorts of things most of us would least like to see done by a machine. There has been a great deal of effort to normalize the idea that caring tasks can or should be carried out by machines, but I don't think it has been or really could be successful in the long run. There's been a lot of scare literature of late about the perils of mechanization. Most of it follows along the lines that Kurt Vonnegut had already developed in his very first novel, Player Piano, in 1952. With most forms of manual labor eliminated, society, these critics warn, will necessarily divide into two classes: a wealthy elite who own and design the robots, and a haggard and disconsolate former working class who spend their days shooting pool and drinking because they have nothing else to do. The middle class would split between them. This obviously not only completely ignored the caring aspects of real labor, it also assumed property relations were unalterable, and that human beings, at least those who were not, say, science fiction writers, were so completely unimaginative that even with unlimited free time, they would be unable to come up with anything particularly interesting to do. It is interesting to note in this context that Vonnegut had, in fact, been enrolled for a master's degree in anthropology at the University of Chicago immediately after the war, though he never completed his dissertation. This no doubt explains why one of the main characters in the book is an anthropologist. Perhaps if he'd studied harder, he'd have realized that his premise, that workers would not be able to handle too much leisure, was profoundly flawed. Ray Fogelson, who was there at the time, told me he returned many years later with a thesis so obviously dashed together it left the department in a quandary, so they decided to grant him a degree instead for Cat's Cradle. The 1960s counterculture challenged the second and third assumptions, though not so much the first one, with many 60s revolutionaries embracing the slogan, "Let the machines do all the work." This in turn led to a renewed backlash of moralizing about work as a value in itself of the sort we've already encountered in Chapter 6. At the same time, as an export of many factory jobs to poor countries where labor was cheap enough, it could still be performed by human beings. It was in the wake of this reaction to the 60s counterculture in the 70s and 80s that the first wave of managerial feudalism and the extreme bullshitization of employment began to make itself felt. The latest wave of robotization has caused the same moral crises and moral panics as the 60s. The only real difference is that, since any significant change in economic models, let alone property regimes, is now treated as definitively off of the table, it's simply assumed the only possible result will be to convey even more wealth and power to the 1%. Martin Ford's recent The Rise of the Robots, for example, documents how, after making most blue-collar workers redundant, Silicon Valley is in the process of taking aim at healthcare, education, and the liberal professions as well. The likely outcome, he predicts, is techno-feudalism. Throwing workers out of work, or impoverishing them by forcing them to compete with machines, will be deeply problematic, he argues, particularly since, without paychecks, how exactly is anyone going to afford all the shiny toys and efficient services the robots will provide? This may be a cruelly simplified summary, but it helps to underline what I think to be missing from such accounts: that predictions of robots replacing humans always go just so far and then stop. It's possible for futurologists to imagine robots replacing sports editors, sociologists, or real estate agents, for example, yet I have yet to see one suggest that the basic functions that capitalists are supposed to perform, which mainly consist of figuring out the optimal way to invest resources in order to answer current or potential future consumer demand, could possibly be performed by a machine. Why not? One could easily make a case that the main reason the Soviet economy worked so badly was because they were never able to develop computer technology efficient enough to coordinate such large amounts of data automatically. But the Soviet Union only made it to the 1980s. Now, it would be easy. Yet no one dares suggest this. The famous Oxford study by engineer Michael Osborne and economist Carl Frey, which sizes up 702 different professions in terms of their susceptibility for being replaced by robots, for instance, considers hydrologists, makeup artists, and travel guides, but makes no mention whatsoever of the possibility of automated entrepreneurs, investors, or financiers. The most likely at 702 is telemarketer, the least at number 1, recreational therapist. Anthropologists such as myself are fairly safe at number 32. The original online version of the paper appeared in 2013 and received a good deal of news coverage at the time. At this point, my own instinct is to turn for inspiration from Vonnegut to a different science fiction writer, Stanislaw Lem, whose space voyager, Ejon Tishy, describes a visit to a planet inhabited by a species to which the author gives the rather unsubtle name of Fools. At the time of his arrival, the Fools were experiencing a classic Marxian overproduction crisis. Traditionally, they had been divided into spirators, priests, eminents, aristocrats, and drudglings, workers. As one helpful native explained, through the ages, inventors built machines that simplified work, and where in ancient times 100 drudglings had bent their sweating backs, centuries later a few stood by a machine. Our scientists improved the machines, and the people rejoiced at that, but subsequent events show how cruelly premature was that rejoicing. The factories ultimately became a little too efficient, and one day an engineer created machines that could operate with no supervision at all. When the new machines appeared in the factories, hordes of drudglings lost their jobs. And, receiving no salary, they faced starvation. "Excuse me, fool," I asked, "but what became of the profits the factories made?" "The profits," he replied, "went to the rightful owners, of course. Now then, as I was saying, the threat of annihilation hung..." "But what are you saying, worthy fool?" I cried. "All that had to be done was to make the factories common property, and the new machines would have become a blessing to you." The minute I say this, the fool trembled, blinked his 10 eyes nervously, and cupped his ears to ascertain whether any of his companions milling about the stairs had overheard my remark. "By the 10 noses of the foo, I implore you, O stranger, do not utter such vile heresy, which attacks the very foundations of our freedom. Our supreme law, the principle of civic initiative, states that no one can be compelled, constrained, or even coaxed to do what he does not wish. Who then would dare expropriate the eminence factories, it being their will to enjoy possession of same? That would be the most horrible violation of liberty imaginable. Now then, to continue, the new machines produced an abundance of extremely cheap goods and excellent food, but the drudglings bought nothing, for they had not the wherewithal. Before long, the drudglings, though, as Tishi's interlocutor insisted, entirely free to do what they wanted provided they did not interfere in anyone else's property rights, were dropping like flies. Much heated debate ensued, and a succession of failed half-measures. The Fool's High Council, the Plenum Moronicum, attempted to replace the drudglings as consumers as well, by creating robots that would eat, use, and enjoy all the products the new machines produced far more intensely than any living being could possibly do, while also materializing money to pay for it. But this was unsatisfying. Finally, realizing a system where both production and consumption were being done by machines was rather pointless, they concluded the best solution would be for the entire population to render itself, entire voluntarily, to the factories to be converted into beautiful shiny discs and arranged in pleasant patterns across the landscape. This might seem heavy-handed, but sometimes I think a dose of heavy-handed Marxism is exactly what we need. Lem was writing in still socialist Poland in the 1970s, but for what it's worth, his satire of Stalinism is just as merciless. On another journey, Ejon Tishi finds himself in a planet governed by a vast irrigation bureaucracy that has become so caught up in their mission that they have developed the ideology that humans are naturally evolving into fish. The inhabitants are forced to practice breathing water for increasing numbers of hours every day. Lem is right. It's hard to imagine a surer sign that one is dealing with an irrational economic system than the fact that the prospect of eliminating drudgery is considered to be a problem. Star Trek solved the problem with replicators, and young radicals here in the United Kingdom sometimes talk about a future of fully automated luxury communism, which is basically the same thing. A case could easily be made that any future robots and replicators should be the common property of humanity as a whole, since they would be the fruit of a collective mechanical intelligence that goes back centuries, in much the same way as a national culture is the creation of, and thus belongs to, everyone. Automated public factories would make life easier. Still, they wouldn't actually eliminate the need for drudglings. Lim's story, and others like it, still assume that work means factory work, or anyway, productive work, and ignore what most working-class jobs actually consist of. For instance, the fact noted in the last chapter that workers in ticket offices in the London Underground aren't there to take tickets but to find lost children and talk down drunks. Not only are robots that could perform such functions very far away, but even if they did exist, most of us would not want such tasks performed in a way a robot would perform them anyway. So, the more automation proceeds, the more it should be obvious that actual value emerges from the caring element of work. Yet this leads to another problem. The caring value of work would appear to be precisely that element in labor that cannot be quantified. Much of the bullshitization of real jobs, I would say, and much of the reason for the expansion of the bullshit sector more generally, is a direct result of the desire to quantify the unquantifiable. To put it bluntly, automation makes certain tasks more efficient, but at the same time, it makes other tasks less efficient. This is because it requires enormous amounts of human labor to render the processes, tasks, and outcomes that surround anything of caring value into a form that computers can even recognize. It is now possible to build a robot that can, all by itself, sort a pile of fresh fruits or vegetables into ripe, raw, and rotten. This is a good thing because sorting fruit, especially for more than an hour or two, is boring. It is not possible to build a robot that can, all by itself, scan over a dozen history course reading lists and decide which is the best course. This isn't such a bad thing either because such work is interesting, or at least it's not hard to locate people who would find it so. One reason to have robots sorting fruit is so that real human beings can have more time to think about what history course they'd prefer to take, or some equally unquantifiable thing like who's their favorite funk guitarist or what color they'd like to dye their hair. However, and here's the catch, if we did for some reason wish to pretend that a computer could decide which is the best history course, say because we decided we need to have uniform, quantifiable quality standards to apply across the university for funding purposes, there's no way that computer could do the task by itself. The fruit, you can just roll into a bin. In the case of the history course, it requires enormous human effort to render the material into units that a computer would even begin to know what to do with. On the political ramifications of bullshitization and consequent decline of productivity in the caring sector as it relates to the possibility of a revolt of the caring classes. Since at least the Great Depression, we've been hearing warnings that automation was or was about to be throwing millions out of work. Keynes, at the time, coined the term technological unemployment, and many assumed the mass unemployment of the 1930s was just a sign of things to come. And while this might make it seem such claims have always been somewhat alarmist, what this book suggests is that the opposite was the case. They were entirely accurate. Automation did, in fact, lead to mass unemployment. We've simply stopped the gap by adding dummy jobs that are effectively made up. A combination of political pressure from both right and left, a deeply held popular feeling that paid employment alone can make one a full moral person, and finally a fear on the part of the upper classes, already noted by George Orwell in 1933, of what the laboring masses might get up to if they had too much leisure on their hands, has ensured that whatever the underlying reality, when it comes to official unemployment figures in wealthy countries, the needle should never jump too far from the range of 3 to 8%. But if one eliminates bullshit jobs from the picture, and the real jobs that only exist to support them, one could say that the catastrophe predicted in the 1930s really did happen. Upward of 50% to 60% of the population has, in fact, been thrown out of work. Except, of course, there's absolutely no reason it should have been a catastrophe. Over the course of the last several thousand years, there have been untold thousands of human groups that might be referred to as societies, and the overwhelming majority of them managed to figure out ways to distribute those tasks that needed to be done to keep them alive in the style to which they were accustomed in such a fashion that most everyone had some way to contribute, and no one had to spend the majority of their waking hours performing tasks they would rather not be doing in the way that people do today. Bear in mind that, averaged over a year, even medieval serfs did not work even close to a 40-hour week. What's more, faced with the problem of abundant leisure time, people in those societies seem to have had little trouble figuring out ways to entertain themselves or otherwise pass the time. I'm not going to dignify here arguments put forward in some quarters that reducing hours of employment will lead to an increase in crime, unhealthy practices, or other negative social effects. I'm sure identical arguments could have been made against freeing slaves, and likely were. I see them as having an equivalent moral standing. How is arguing that people should be forced to work 40 hours a week they would not otherwise have to work because they might otherwise drink, smoke, or commit crimes any different from arguing that the entire population should be placed in prison for an equivalent amount of time as a form of preventative detention? From the perspective of anyone born in one of those past societies, we'd probably look just as irrational as the fools to Ijon Tishi. The reason the current allocation of labor looks the way it does, then, has nothing to do with economics or even human nature. It's ultimately political. There was no reason we had to try to quantify the value of caring labor. There is no real reason we have to continue to do so. We could stop. But before we launch a campaign to reconstitute work and how we value it, I think we would do well to once again consider carefully the political forces at play. One way to think about what's happened is to return to the opposition between value and values, through which perspective, of course, what we are seeing is an attempt to force one to submit to the logic of the other. Before the Industrial Revolution, most people worked at home. It's only since, perhaps, 1750 or even 1800 that it's made any sense to talk about society as we typically do today, as if it were made up of a collection of factories and offices, workplaces, on the one hand, and a collection of homes, schools, churches, water parks, and the like on the other, presumably with a giant shopping mall placed somewhere in between. If work is the domain of production, then home is the domain of consumption, which is also, of course, the domain of values, which means that what work people do engage in this domain, they largely do for free. But you could also flip the whole thing around and look at society from the opposite point of view. From the perspective of business, yes, homes and schools are just the places we produce and raise and train a capable workforce. But from a human perspective, that's about as crazy as building a million robots to consume the food that people can no longer afford to eat, or warning African countries, as the World Bank has occasionally been known to do, that they need to do more to control HIV because if everyone is dead, it will have adverse effects on the economy. As Karl Marx once pointed out, prior to the Industrial Revolution, it never seems to have occurred to anyone to write a book asking what conditions would create the most overall wealth. Many, however, wrote books about what conditions would create the best people. That is, how should society be best arranged to produce the sort of human beings one would like to have around, as friends, lovers, neighbors, relatives, or fellow citizens? This is the kind of question that concerned Aristotle, Confucius, and Ibn Khaldun, and in the final analysis, it's still the only really important one. Human life is a process by which we as humans create one another. Even the most extreme individualists only become individuals through the care and support of their fellows. And the economy is ultimately just the way we provide ourselves with the necessary material provisions with which to do so. If so, talking about values, which are valuable because they can't be reduced to numbers, is the way that we have traditionally talked about the process of mutual creation and caring. One might call it human production, and I have done so elsewhere, but in this context, even that seems to hit the wrong note. Now, clearly, if we assume this to be true, then the domain of value has been systematically invading the domain of values for at least the last 50 years, and it's hardly surprising that political arguments have come to take the form they do. For instance, in many major American cities, the largest employers are now universities and hospitals. The economy of such cities, then, centers on a vast apparatus of production and maintenance of human beings, divided in good Cartesian fashion between educational institutions designed to shape the mind and medical institutions designed to maintain the body. In other cities, such as New York, universities and hospitals come in second and third as employers, the biggest employers being banks. I'll get back to banks in a moment. Where once left-wing political parties at least claimed to represent factory workers, nowadays all such pretense has been discarded, and they have come to be dominated by the professional managerial classes that run institutions like schools and hospitals. Right-wing populism has taken systematic aim at the authority of those institutions in the name of a different set of religious or patriarchal values. For instance, challenging the authority of universities by rejecting climate science or evolution, or challenging the authority of the medical system by campaigns against contraception or abortion. Or it has dabbled in impossible fantasies about returning to the industrial age, Trump. But really, this is something of a bitter ender game. Realistically, the likelihood of right populists in America wresting control of the apparatus of human production from the corporate left is about as great as the likelihood of a socialist party taking power in America and collectivizing heavy industry. For the moment, it would appear to be a standoff. The mainstream left largely controls the production of humans. The mainstream right largely controls the production of things. It's in this context that the financialization and bullshitization of both the corporate sector and particularly the caring sector are taking place, leading to ever higher social costs, even at the same time as those who are doing the actual frontline caring are finding themselves increasingly squeezed. Everything seems to be in place for a revolt of the caring classes. Why has none yet taken place? Well, one obvious reason is the way that right-wing populism and divide-and-conquer racism have placed many of the caring classes in opposite camps. But on top of that, there's the even stickier problem that in many areas of dispute, both sides are supposed to be in the same political camp. This is where banks come in. The entanglement of banks, universities, and hospitals has become truly insidious. Finance works its way into everything, from car loans to credit cards, but it's significant that the principal cause of bankruptcy in America is medical debt, and the principal force drawing young people into bullshit jobs is the need to pay student loans. Yet since Clinton in the United States and Blair in the United Kingdom, it's been the ostensibly left parties that have most embraced the rule of finance, received the largest contributions from the financial sector, and worked the most closely with financial lobbyists to reform the laws to make all this possible. No doubt one could quibble over who received the most money from whom in what circumstances, but it was Bill Clinton who presided over the repeal of Glass-Steagall, thus liberalizing finance and opening the way to the 2008-2009 crisis, and Tony Blair in the UK who first introduced tuition fees in the British universities. It was exactly at the same time that these same parties self-consciously rejected any remaining elements of their old working-class constituencies, and instead became, as Tom Frank has so effectively demonstrated, the parties of the professional managerial class. That is, not just doctors and lawyers, but the administrators and managers actually responsible for the bullshitization of the caring sectors of the economy. If nurses were to rebel against the fact that they have to spend the bulk of their shifts doing paperwork, they would have to rebel against their own union leaders, who are firmly allied with the Clintonite Democratic Party, whose core support comes from the hospital administrators responsible for imposing the paperwork on them to begin with. If teachers were to rebel, they'd have to rebel against school administrators, who are actually represented in many cases by the exact same union. If they protest too loudly, they will simply be told they have no choice but to accept bullshitization, because the only alternative is to surrender to the racist barbarians of the populist right. I have myself smashed my head against this dilemma repeatedly. Back in 2006, when I was being kicked out of Yale for my support of grad students engaged in a teacher unionization drive, the anthropology department had to get special permission to change the reappointment rules for my case, and my case only, in order to get rid of me. Union strategists considered a campaign on my behalf on MoveOn.org and similar left-liberal mailing lists, until reminded that the Yale administrators behind my dismissal were probably active on those lists themselves. Years later, with Occupy Wall Street, which might be considered the first great rising of the caring classes, I watched those same progressive professional managerials first attempt to co-opt the movement for the Democratic Party, then, when that proved impossible, sit idly by or even collude while a peaceful movement was suppressed by military force. On universal basic income, as an example of a program that might begin to detach work from compensation and put an end to the dilemmas described in this book. I don't usually like putting policy recommendations in my books. One reason for this is that it has been my experience that if an author is critical of existing social arrangements, reviewers will often respond by effectively asking, "So, what are you proposing to do about it then?" Search the text until they find something that looks like a policy suggestion, and then act as if that is what the book is basically about. So, if I were to suggest that a mass reduction of working hours or a policy of universal basic income might go far in solving the problems described here, the likely response will be to see this as a book about reducing working hours or about universal basic income, and to treat it as if it stands and falls on the workability of that policy, or even the ease by which it could be implemented. That would be deceptive. This is not a book about a particular solution. It's a book about a problem, one that most people don't even acknowledge exists. Another reason I hesitate to make policy suggestions is that I am suspicious of the very idea of policy. Policy implies the existence of an elite group, government officials typically, that gets to decide on something, a policy, that they then arrange to be imposed on everybody else. There's a little mental trick we often play on ourselves when discussing such matters. We say, for instance, "What are we going to do about the problem of X?" As if we were society as a whole, somehow acting on ourselves, but in fact, unless we happen to be part of that roughly 3% to 5% of the population whose views actually do affect policymakers, this is all a game of make-believe. We are identifying with our rulers when in fact, we're the ones being ruled. This is what happens when we watch a politician on television say, "What shall we do about the less fortunate?" even though at least half of us would almost certainly fit that category ourselves. Myself, I find such games particularly pernicious because I'd prefer not to have policy elites around at all. I'm personally an anarchist, which means that not only do I look forward to a day sometime in the future when governments, corporations, and the rest will be looked at as historical curiosities in the same way as we now look at the Spanish Inquisition or nomadic invasions, but I prefer solutions to immediate problems that do not give more power to government or corporations, but rather give people the means to manage their own affairs. It follows that when faced with a social problem, my impulse is not to imagine myself in charge and ponder what sort of solutions I would then impose, but to look for a movement already out there, already trying to address the problem and create its own solutions. The problem of bullshit jobs, though, presents unusual challenges in this regard. There are no anti-bullshit job movements. This is partly because most people don't acknowledge the proliferation of bullshit jobs to be a problem, but also because even if they did, it would be difficult to organize a movement around such a problem. What local initiatives might such a movement propose? One could imagine unions or other worker organizations launching anti-bullshit initiatives in their own workplaces, or even across specific industries, but they would presumably call for the de-bullshitization of real work rather than firing people in unnecessary positions. It's not at all clear what a broader campaign against bullshit jobs would even look like. One might try to shorten the working week and hope things would sort themselves out in response. But it seems unlikely that they would. Even a successful campaign for a 15-hour week would be unlikely to cause the unnecessary jobs and industries to be spontaneously abandoned. At the same time, calling for a new government bureaucracy to assess the usefulness of jobs would inevitably itself turn into a vast generator of bullshit. So would a guaranteed jobs program. I've only been able to identify one solution currently being promoted by social movements that would reduce rather than increase the size and intrusiveness of government. That's universal basic income. Let me end with a final testimony from an activist friend whose political purpose in life is to render her own bullshit job unnecessary, and one of her fellow activists. Leslie is a benefits advisor in the United Kingdom. That is, she works for an NGO whose purpose is to guide citizens through the elaborate obstacle course successive governments have set up to make it as difficult as possible for those out of work or otherwise in material need to get access to the money the government claims it has set apart for them. Here is the testimony she sent in. Leslie. My job shouldn't be necessary, but it is, because of the whole long train of bullshit jobs invented to keep people who need money from having it. As if claiming any kind of benefit were not Kafkaesque, intrusive, and humiliating enough, they also make it incredibly complicated. Even when someone is entitled to something, the process of applying is so complex, most need help to understand the questions and their own rights. Leslie has had to deal for years with the insanity that ensues when one tries to reduce human caring to a format that can be recognized by computers, let alone computers designed to keep caring precisely limited. As a result, she ends up in much the same position as Tanya in Chapter 2, who had to spend hours rewriting job applicants' CVs and coaching them on which keywords to use to make it past the computer. Leslie. There are now certain words which have to be used on the forms. I call it the catechism, which if not used can result in a failed claim. But these are only known by those like myself who have had training and access to the handbooks. And even then, especially for disability claims, the claimant often ends up having to fight through to a tribunal to get their entitlement recognized. I do get a little thrill every time we win through for someone. But this doesn't make up for the anger I feel about the colossal waste of everyone's time this is. For the claimant, for me, for the various bods at the DWP, Department of Works and Pensions, who deal with the claim, for the judges at the tribunals, the experts called in to support either side, isn't there something more constructive we could all be doing, like, I don't know, installing solar panels or gardening? I also often wonder about whoever made up these rules. How much did they get paid for it? How long did it take them? How many people were involved? To their minds, I guess they were ensuring that the non-eligible don't get money. And then I think of visiting aliens laughing at us, humans inventing rules to prevent other humans from getting access to tokens of a human concept, money, which is by its nature not scarce. On top of all that, since she is a do-gooder, Leslie can expect to make only a minimal living herself, and the money to run her office itself involves satisfying an endless chain of self-satisfied paper pushers. Leslie. To add insult to injury, my work is funded by charity trusts, a whole other long chain of BS jobs, from me applying for money up to the CEOs who claim their organizations fight poverty or make the world a better place. At my end, this starts with hours searching for relevant funds, reading their guidelines, spending time learning how to best approach them, filling out forms, making phone calls. If successful, I'll next have to spend hours every month compiling statistics and filling out monitoring forms. Each trust has its own catechism and its own set of indicators. Each wants their own set of evidence that we are empowering people or creating change or innovation when, in fact, we're juggling rules and language on behalf of people who just need help to fill out the paperwork so they can get on with their lives. Leslie told me of studies that demonstrates that any system of means testing, no matter how it's framed, will necessarily mean at least 20% of those who legitimately qualify for benefits give up and don't apply. That's almost certainly more than the number of cheats who might be detected by the rules. In fact, even counting those who are honestly mistaken, the number still only comes to 1.6%. The 20% figure would apply even if no one actually was formally denied benefits at all. But of course, the rules are designed to deny as many claimants as can plausibly be denied. Between sanctions and capricious applications of the rules, we've gotten to the point now where 60% of those eligible for unemployment benefits in the United Kingdom don't get them. In other words, Everyone she describes, the entire archipelago that starts with the bureaucrats who write the rules and includes the DWP, enforcement tribunals, advocates, and employees who work for the funding bodies that process applications for the NGOs that employ those advocates, all of them are part of a single vast apparatus that exists to maintain the illusion that people are naturally lazy and don't really want to work. And therefore, that even if society does have a responsibility to ensure they don't literally starve to death, it is necessary to make the process of providing them with the means of continued existence as confusing, time-consuming, and humiliating as possible. The job, then, is essentially a kind of horrific combination of box-ticking and duct-taping, making up for the inefficiencies of a system of caregiving intentionally designed not to work. Thousands of people are maintained on comfortable salaries in air-conditioned offices simply in order to ensure that poor people continue to feel bad about themselves. Leslie knew this better than anyone because she'd spent time on both sides of the desk. She had been on benefits herself for years as a single mother. She knew exactly what things looked like on the receiving end. Her solution? Eliminate the apparatus entirely. She is involved in the movement for universal basic income, which calls for replacing all means-tested social welfare benefits with a flat fee to be paid to everyone equally residing in the country. Candy, a fellow basic income activist, who also held a useless job in the system whose details she preferred not to disclose, told me she originally became interested in such issues when she first moved to London in the 1980s and became part of the International Wages for Housework movement. Candy.
I got involved in Wages for Housework because I felt that my mother needed it. She was trapped in a bad marriage, and she would have left my dad a lot earlier if she'd had her own money. That's something really important for anyone in an abusive or even just boring relationship, to be able to get out of it without being financially impacted. I'd just been in London for a year. I'd been trying to get involved in some form of feminism back in the States. One of my formative memories was my mother taking me to a consciousness-raising group in Ohio when I was 9. We ripped out pages from St. Paul's Gospel where he was talking about how terrible women are and made a pile of them. And because I was the youngest member of the group, they told me to light the pile. I remember I wouldn't do it at first because I'd been taught not to play with matches.
David, but you did eventually light it.
Candy.
I did. My mother gave me permission. Not long after that, she got a job that paid enough to live on, and immediately she left my dad. That was kind of proof in the pudding for me.
In London, Candy found herself drawn to Wages for Housework, then widely seen by most other feminists as an annoying, if not dangerous, fringe group, because she saw it as providing an alternative to sterile debates between liberals and separatists. Here, at least, was an economic analysis of the real-life problems women faced. Some, at the time, were beginning to speak of a global work machine, a planet-wide wage labor system designed to pump more and more effort out of more and more people. But what feminist critics had begun pointing out was that same system also defined what was to be considered real labor, the kind that could be reduced to time and could thus be bought and sold, and what wasn't. Most women's labor was placed in the latter category, despite the fact that without it, the very machine that stamped it as not really work would grind to a halt immediately. Wages for Housework was essentially an attempt to call capitalism's bluff, to say, most work, even factory work, is done for a variety of motives. But if you want to insist that work is only valuable as a marketable commodity, then at least you can be consistent about the matter. If women were to be compensated in the same way as men, then a huge proportion of the world's wealth would instantly have to be handed over to them. And wealth, of course, is power. What follows is from a conversation with both of them. David. So, inside Wages for Housework, were there many debates about the policy implications? You know, the mechanisms through which the wages would actually be paid?
Candy. Oh, no, it was much more perspective, a way to expose the unpaid work that was being done that nobody was supposed to talk about. And for that, it did a really good job. Few were talking about the work women were already doing for free in the 1960s, but it became an issue when wages for housework was established in the 1970s, and now it's standard to take it into account when working out divorce settlements, for example.
David. So the demand itself was basically a provocation. Candy.
It was much more a provocation than it was ever a plan. This is how we could actually do it, anything like that. We did talk about where the money would come from. At first, it was all about getting money out of capital. Then, in the later 80s, Wilmette Brown's book, Black Women and the Peace Movement, came out, all about how war and the war economy affects women, and particularly black women, more than anyone else. So we started using the slogan, pay women, not soldiers. Actually, you still hear that, wage caring, not killing. So we certainly targeted where the money was, but we never much got into the mechanics.
David, wait, wage caring, not killing. Whose slogan is that? Leslie.
Global Women's Strike. That's the contemporary successor to Wages for Housework. When we came out with the first European UBI, Universal Basic Income petition, back in 2013, that was Global Women's Strike's response. 2 months later, they put out a petition to wage carers instead. Which myself, I wouldn't have a problem with if they were willing to admit that everyone is a carer in one form or another. If you're not looking after someone else, then at the very least, you're looking after yourself, and this takes time and energy the system is less and less willing to afford people. But then recognizing that would just lead back to UBI again. If everyone's a carer, then you might as well just fund everybody and let them decide for themselves who they want to care for at any given time.
Candy had come around from Wages for Housework to UBI for similar reasons. She and some of her fellow activists started asking themselves, say we did want to promote a real practical program, what would that be? Candy.
The reaction we used to get on the street when we leafleted for Wages for Housework was either women would say, great, where can I sign up? Or they'd say, how dare you demand money for something I do for love? That second reaction wasn't entirely crazy. These women were understandably resistant to commodifying all human activity in the way that getting a wage for housework might imply.
Candy was particularly moved by the arguments of the French socialist thinker André Gorche. When I offered my own analysis on the inherently unquantifiable nature of caring, she told me Gorche had anticipated it 40 years ago. Candy.
Gorsh's critique of wages for housework was that if you kept emphasizing the importance of care to the global economy in strictly financial terms, then there was the danger that you'd end up putting a dollar value on different forms of caring and saying, that's its real value. But in that case, you were running the risk of more and more of that caring becoming monetized, quantified, and therefore kind of fucked up, because monetizing those activities often decreases the qualitative value of the care, especially if it's done, as it is usually, as a list of specific tasks with set time limits. He was already saying that in the 70s, and now, of course, that's exactly what's transpired. Even in teaching, nursing.
Gorsh's actual words, the search for higher productivity would lead to the standardization and industrialization of such activities, particularly those involving the feeding, minding, raising, and education of children. The last enclave of individual or communal autonomy would disappear. Socialization, commodification, and pre-programming would be extended to the last vestiges of self-determined and self-regulated life. The industrialization, through home computers, of physical and psychical care and hygiene, children's education, cooking, or sexual technique is precisely designed to generate capitalist profits from activities still left to individual fantasy. Gorsh is originally published in French in 1980, which makes it really quite prophetic. The more specific engagement with the Wages for Housework movement is in Critique of Economic Reason.
Leslie. Let alone what I do.
David. Yeah, I know. Bullshitization is my phrase. Candy.
Yes, it's been bullshitized, absolutely.
Leslie.
Whereas UBI, didn't Silvia Federici write or talk in an interview recently about how the UN and then all sorts of world bodies kind of glommed on to feminism as a way to resolve the capitalist crisis of the 70s? They said, sure, let's bring women and carers into the paid workforce. Most working class women were already doing a double day. Not to empower women, but as a way of disciplining men. Because insofar as you see an equalization of wages since then, it's mainly because, in real terms, working class men's wages have gone down, not because women are necessarily getting that much more. They're always trying to set us against each other. And that's what all these mechanisms for assessing the relative value of different kinds of work are necessarily going to be about. That's why, for me, the pilot study of basic income carried out in India is so exciting. Well, a lot of things are exciting about it. For instance, domestic violence goes way down. This makes sense because I think some 80% of domestic disputes that lead to violence turn out to be about money. But the main thing is, it starts to make social inequalities dissolve. You start by giving everyone an equal amount of money. That in itself is important because money has a certain symbolic power. It's something that's the same for everyone. And when you give everyone, men, women, old, young, high caste, low caste, exactly the same amount, those differences start to dissolve. This happened in the Indian pilot, where they observed that the girls were given the same amount of food as boys, unlike before. Disabled people were more accepted in village activities, and young women dropped the social convention that said they were supposed to be shy and modest and started hanging around in public like boys. Girls started participating in public life. And any UBI payment would have to be enough to live on all by itself, and it would have to be completely unqualified. Everyone has to get it, even people who don't need it. It's worth it just to establish the principle that when it comes to what's required to live, everyone deserves that equally without qualification. This makes it a human right, not just charity or duct tape for lack of other forms of income. Then, if there are further needs on top of that, say someone is disabled, well, then you address that too, but only after you establish the right of material existence for all people.
This is one of the elements that startles and confuses a lot of people when they first hear about the concept of basic income. Surely you aren't going to give $25,000 a year, or whatever it is, to Rockefellers too. The answer is yes. Everyone is everyone. It's not like there are so many billionaires this will come to a particularly large amount of money. Rich people could be taxed more anyway. If one wanted to start means testing, even for billionaires, then one would have to set up a bureaucracy to start means testing again, and if history tells us anything, it's that such bureaucracies tend to expand. What basic income ultimately proposes is to detach livelihood from work. Its immediate effect would be to massively reduce the amount of bureaucracy in any country that implemented it. As Leslie's case shows, an enormous amount of the machinery of government, and that half-government corporate NGO penumbra that surround it in most wealthy societies, is just there to make poor people feel bad about themselves. It's an extraordinarily expensive moral game played to prop up a largely useless global work machine. Candy.
Let me give an example. Recently, I was thinking maybe I'd foster a kid. So I looked into the package. It's quite generous. You get a council flat, and on top of that, you get £250 a week to look after the child. But then I realized, wait a minute. They're talking about £13,000 a year and an apartment for one child, which the child's parents in probably most cases didn't have. If we'd just given the same thing to the parents, so they didn't get into so many problems, they'd never have had to foster the child to begin with. And of course, that's not even counting the cost of the salaries of the civil servants who arrange and monitor fosterage, the building and upkeep of the offices in which they work, the various bodies that monitor and control those civil servants, the building and upkeep of the offices in which they work, and so forth.
This is not the place to enter into arguments about how a basic income program might actually work. For the most thorough recent exploration of the current arguments for basic income, see Standing 2017. If it seems implausible to most, but where would the money come from? It's largely because we've all grown up with largely false assumptions about what money is, how it's produced, what taxes are really for, and a host of other issues that lie far beyond the scope of this volume. Waters are further muddied by the fact that there are radically different visions of what a universal income is and why it would be good to have one, ranging from a conservative version that aims to provide a modest stipend as a pretext to completely eliminate existing welfare state provisions like free education or healthcare and just submit everything to the market, to a radical version such as Leslie and Candy support, which assumes existing unconditional guarantees like the British National Health Service will be left in place. In fact, in some ways, they might have to be expanded. One could make the argument UBI wouldn't work with a rent-based economy because, say, if most homes were rented, landlords would just double rents to grab the additional income. At the very least, controls would have to be imposed. One sees basic income as a way of contracting. The other sees it as a way of expanding the zone of unconditionality. This latter is the kind that I would myself be able to get behind. I do this despite my own politics, which is quite explicitly anti-statist. As an anarchist, I look forward to seeing states dismantled entirely, and in the meantime, have no interest in policies that will give states more power than they have already. But oddly, this is why I can get behind basic income. Basic income might seem like it is a vast expansion of state power, since presumably it's the government, or some quasi-state institution like a central bank, that would be creating and distributing the money, but in fact, it's exactly the reverse. Huge sections of government, and precisely the most intrusive and obnoxious ones, since they are most deeply involved in the moral surveillance of ordinary citizens, would be instantly made unnecessary and could be simply closed down. This is also why conditional versions of the same program, or guaranteed jobs programs, are in no sense variations on, let alone improved versions of, the same thing. The key to UBI is the unconditional element, which allows for a massive reduction of the role of government intrusion in citizens' lives. These supposedly modified or improved versions either will not do this or will have the opposite effect. Yes, millions of minor government officials and benefit advisors like Leslie would be thrown out of their current jobs, but they'd all receive basic income too. Maybe some of them will come up with something genuinely important to do, like installing solar panels, as Leslie suggests, or discovering the cure for cancer. But it wouldn't matter if they instead formed jug bands, devoted themselves to restoring antique furniture, spelunking, translating Mayan hieroglyphics, or trying to set the world record for having sex at an advanced age. Let them do what they like. Whatever they end up doing, they will almost certainly be happier than they are now, imposing sanctions on the unemployed for arriving late at CV building seminars or checking to see if the homeless are in possession of 3 forms of ID. And everybody else will be better off for their newfound happiness. Even a modest basic income program could become a stepping stone toward the most profound transformation of all, to unlatch work from livelihood entirely. As we saw in the last chapter, a strong moral case can be made for paying everyone the same regardless of their work. Yet the argument cited in that chapter did assume people were being paid for their work, and this would at the very least require some kind of monitoring bureaucracy to ensure that people were, in fact, working, even if it did not have to measure how hard or how much they produced. A full basic income would eliminate the compulsion to work by offering a reasonable standard of living to all, and then either leaving it up to each individual to decide whether they wish to pursue further wealth by doing a paying job or selling something, or whether they wish to do something else with their time. Alternately, it might open the way to developing better ways of distributing goods entirely. Money is, after all, a rationing ticket, and in an ideal world, one would presumably wish to do as little rationing as possible. Obviously, all this depends on the assumption that human beings don't have to be compelled to work, or at least
to do something that they feel is useful or beneficial to others. As we've seen, this is a reasonable assumption. Most people would prefer not to spend their days sitting around watching TV, and the handful who really are inclined to be total parasites are not going to be a significant burden on society, since the total amount of work required to maintain people in comfort and security is not that formidable. The compulsive workaholics who insist on doing far more than they really have to would more than compensate for the occasional slackers. Obviously, moral philosophy tends to assume that the free rider problem is a fundamental question of social justice, outweighing considerations of human freedom, and therefore usually concludes that it would be justifiable to set up a system of surveillance and coercion so as to ensure that not even a small number of people live off of others' work, unless they're rich, in which case that's usually somehow totally okay. My own position, which is the typical libertarian socialist position, is, so what if they do? Finally, the concept of unconditional universal support is directly relevant to two issues that have come up repeatedly over the course of this book. The first is the sadomasochistic dynamic of hierarchical work arrangements, a dynamic that tends to be sharply exacerbated when everyone knows the work to be pointless. A lot of the day-to-day misery in working people's lives springs directly from this source. In Chapter 4, I cited Lynn Chancer's notion of sadomasochism in everyday life, and particularly the point that, unlike actual BDSM play, where there's always a safe word, when normal people fall into the same dynamic, there's never such an easy way out. You can't say orange to your boss. It's always occurred to me this insight is important and could even become the basis for a theory of social liberation. I like to think that Michel Foucault, the French social philosopher, was moving in this direction before his tragic death in 1984. Foucault, according to people who knew him, underwent a remarkable personal transformation on discovering BDSM, turning from a notoriously cagey and standoffish personality to one suddenly warm, open, and friendly. I never met Foucault, but I base my descriptions on some of those who did. But his theoretical ideas also entered into a period of transformation that he was never able to fully bring to fruit. Foucault, of course, is famous mainly as a theorist of power, which he saw as flowing through all human relationships, even as the basic substance of human sociality, since he once defined it as simply a matter of acting on another's actions. It's sometimes said that Foucault never defines power, and it's true that he was often slightly coy about the matter, but when he did, he defined power as a set of actions on others' actions, and its exercise as acting on another's actions. This is, surprisingly, closer to the Parsonian tradition than anything else. This always created a peculiar paradox because, while he wrote in such a way as to suggest he was an anti-authoritarian opposed to power, he defined power in such a way that social life would be impossible without it. At the very end of his career, he seems to have aimed to resolve the dilemma by introducing a distinction between what he called power and domination. The first, he said, was just a matter of strategic games. Everyone is playing power games all the time, we can hardly help it, but neither is there anything objectionable about our doing so. So in this, his very last interview, power is not an evil. Power is strategic games. We know very well that power is not an evil. Take, for example, sexual relationship or love relationships. To exercise power over another, in a sort of open strategic game where things could be reversed, that is not evil. That is part of love, passion, of sexual pleasure. It seems to me we must distinguish the relations of power as strategic games between liberties, strategic games that result from the fact that some people try to determine the conduct of others, and the states of domination, which are what we ordinarily call power. Foucault isn't quite explicit on how we are to distinguish one from the other than to say that in domination, things are not open and cannot be reversed. Otherwise, fluid relations of power become rigid and congealed.
He gives the example of the mutual manipulation of teacher and student, power good, versus the tyranny of the authoritarian pedant, domination bad. I think Foucault is circling around something here and never quite gets to the promised land. A safe word theory of social liberation. Because this would be the obvious solution. It's not so much that certain games are fixed. Some people like fixed games for whatever reason, but that sometimes you can't get out of them. The question then does indeed become, what would be the equivalent of saying orange to one's boss? Or to an insufferable bureaucrat, obnoxious academic advisor, or abusive boyfriend? How do we create only games that we actually feel like playing because we can opt out at any time? In the economic field, at least, the answer is obvious. All of the gratuitous sadism of workplace politics depends on one's inability to say, I quit, and feel no economic consequences. If Annie's boss knew Annie's income would be unaffected even if she did walk off in disgust at being called out yet again for a problem she'd fixed months ago, she would know better than to call her into the office to begin with. Basic income in this sense would indeed give workers the power to say orange to their boss. Which leads to the second theme. It's not just that Annie's boss would have to treat her with at least a small degree of dignity and respect in a world of guaranteed incomes. If universal basic income was instituted, it's very hard to imagine jobs like Annie's long continue to exist. One could well imagine people who didn't have to work to survive still choosing to become dental assistants or toy makers or movie ushers or tugboat operators or even sewage treatment plant inspectors. It's even easier to imagine them choosing to become some combination of several of these. It's extremely difficult to imagine someone living without financial constraints choosing to spend any significant amount of their time highlighting forms for a medical care cost management company, let alone in an office where underlings were not allowed to speak. In such a world, Annie would have no reason to give up on being a preschool teacher, unless she actually decided she was no longer interested in being a preschool teacher. And if medical care cost management companies continued to exist, they would have to figure out another way to highlight their forms. It's unlikely medical care cost management companies would exist for long. The need for such firms, if you can even call it a need, is a direct result of a bizarre and labyrinthine U.S. healthcare system which overwhelming majorities of Americans see as idiotic and unjust, and which they wish to see replaced by some kind of public insurance or public health provider. As we have seen, one of the main reasons this system has not been replaced, at least if President Obama's own account is to be believed, is precisely because its inefficiency creates jobs like Annie's. If nothing else, universal basic income would mean millions of people who recognize the absurdity of this situation will have the time to engage in political organizing to change it, since they will no longer be forced to highlight forms for 8 hours a day or, if they insist on doing something useful with their lives, scramble around for an equivalent amount of time trying to figure out a way to pay the bills. It's hard to escape the impression that, for many of those who, like Obama, defend the existence of bullshit jobs, that's one of the most appealing things about such arrangements. As Orwell noted, a population busy working, even at completely useless occupations, doesn't have time to do much else. At the very least, this is further incentive not to do anything about the situation. Be this as it may, however, it opens the way to my second and final point. The first objection typically raised when someone suggests guaranteeing everyone a livelihood regardless of work is that if you do so, people simply won't work. This is just obviously false, and at this point, I think we can dismiss it out of hand. The second, more serious objection is that most will work, but many will choose work that's of interest only to themselves. The streets would fill up with bad poets, annoying street mimes, and promoters of crank scientific theories, and nothing would get done. What the phenomenon of bullshit jobs really brings home is the foolishness of such assumptions. No doubt a certain proportion of the population of a free society would spend their lives on projects most others would consider to be silly or pointless. But it's hard to imagine how it would go much over 10 or 20%. But already, right now, 37 to 40% of workers in rich countries already feel their jobs are pointless. Roughly half the economy consists of, or exists in support of, bullshit. And it's not even particularly interesting bullshit. If we let everyone decide for themselves how they were best fit to benefit humanity with no restrictions at all, how could they possibly end up with a distribution of labor more inefficient than the one we already have? This is a powerful argument for human freedom. Most of us like to talk about freedom in the abstract, even claim that it's the most important thing for anyone to fight or die for. But we don't think a lot about what being free or practicing freedom might actually mean. The main point of this book was not to propose concrete policy prescriptions, but to start us thinking and arguing about what a genuine free society might actually be like. This audiobook was produced and published by Penguin Books Limited, recording copyright 2018.